Today, I had the pleasure to have a conversation with Harvey Silverglade. He is an American attorney, author, and civil liberties advocate. He is best known for his work in defending individual rights and freedom of speech. Silverglade has been involved in numerous high-profile cases and has written extensively on issues related to civil liberties and the criminal justice system. He co-founded the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, FIRE, in 1999, an organization dedicated to protecting free speech and due process rights. He has also written several books, including Three Felonies a Day, How the Feds Target the Innocent, Conviction Machine, Standing Up to Federal Prosecutorial Abuse, and The Shadow University, The Betrayal of Liberty on America's Campuses. In our conversation, we talked about the similarities between free speech, the scientific method, and traditional liberal values, how the decentralized marketplace of ideas is better at finding truth than centralized power, how interests are aligned in the long term, how intolerance to opposing ideas fuels censorship, the impossibility of China overcoming the US as the world's superpower due to the internal corruptness of its system, the primacy of freedom of speech over material abundance, even if they are complementary, the need for the smallest units to be subjected to a process of natural selection so that bigger ones can prevail, as in the purpose of dialogue is to let ideas die instead of us, how dogmatism forced Larry Summers to resign his position as president from Harvard, Harvey's marriage advice, that bureaucracy is a construction by which a person is conveniently separated from the consequences of his actions, how administrators drain colleges' resources, the counterproductive and racist nature of affirmative action, the role of freedom of speech in allowing non-mainstream opinions to be voiced, meritocracy, and how we have nothing apart from dialogue as an alternative to violence. I consider freedom of speech and the scientific method to be the topic, as its importance easily eclipses everything else. And I am enormously grateful for Harvey to have been so generous with his time in the willingness to engage in a dialogue with me. This really is how we learn to deal with our internal devils, and it is our duty as a civilization to become masters at it, because extinction has never been so prominently available in the menu. Technological progress is a double-edged sword. We have to get this right the first time, as there might not be a second try. Let's engage in that one. Harvey, I've been thinking lately quite a bit about the connection between free speech, the scientific method, and traditional liberal values like live and let live. And I think on some days I wake up thinking that they are the same thing. At some level, they are the same thing because there's a huge overlap between them. Would you agree with me?
Yeah. Well, there is a tremendous overlap between free speech and scientific method. And you want me to explain that?
Sure.
Okay. The idea behind free speech, at least in theory, as the Supreme Court has consistently held, whether it was conservative courts or liberal courts, they disagree on a lot of things, but they agree on free speech. And that is this: out of a situation where there's a clash of ideas, ultimately truth emerges. If not truth, then at least the better decision emerges. When you have a country with a dictator, that dictator decides everything. And if that dictator makes a woefully wrong decision, then you have calamity. And in a democracy which has free speech, you have a clash of ideas, you have discussion, you have argument, you have debate. Out of that, history shows, usually a better decision arises. This is the clash of ideas and what one Supreme Court justice called the great marketplace of free ideas, or the free marketplace of ideas. And it is historically proven to be true that the reason democracies flourish much more than dictatorships is largely because dictatorships end up making fatal errors at some point because they depend on the judgment of one guy. I could tell you that Russia is being destroyed by Vladimir Putin, and it's about to lose a war against an adversary that's one third the size, because in Ukraine, they have free speech and they're able to argue about military strategy. They're able to rev up their production of material. And in Russia, one man makes a mistake or gives an order that's absolutely out, you know, off the wall, and it's destruction reigns. So we know we're proving it now, but it's been proven. It was proven during the Second World War. The Nazi war machine was unrivaled in the world, but Franklin Roosevelt managed to get the American war machine superior in a couple of years. And that was because we were a free society. We rose to the occasion.
I think what you're saying has a lot to do with the economic calculus problem that Mises showed. When power is centralized, the process of acquiring information is not subject to a process of natural selection on a decentralized manner, which would be required to not put all of our eggs in a single basket. If we do, we either lose everything or win everything, but knowing that no single judgment is optimal, as it has been proven in the past, locking ourselves to the standard we have currently is suboptimal, always.
Well, remember this. In a dictatorship, the people in the government, the people in the military, they really hesitate to give the dictator bad news. So the dictator gets a rosier picture than the truth. In this country, the president, the armed forces chief of staff, they get the truth, what's really happening, and they're able to do something about it. You know, one of the ways that I have always put it is this. I'm a free speech absolutist. I don't believe there's such a thing as hate speech. At least there's no such thing as hate speech that should be outlawed. It doesn't matter how hateful. It doesn't matter what epithets are used. I think hate speech is very useful. Useful. It's actually more useful than what I call love speech. Why is it so useful? I like to be told by people that they like me or that they love me. However, I find it much more useful if people can tell me they hate me, they disagree with me. Why? Well, for one thing, I know on whom I should not turn my back. It is really useful to know who's got a dagger. Julius Caesar, known who had a dagger, he would have still been head of Rome in any event. So hate speech should be protected 100%.
There's a quote I love that is, the truth will set you free, but first it will piss you off.
Yes.
That's precisely what you're saying. Hearing negative feedback, it's inconvenient in the short term, but it is the thing that fuels prosperity. This is incredibly analogous to, I have a quote saved here. I wanted to show it to you. In a long-term game, it seems that everybody is making each other rich. And in a short-term game, it seems like everybody is making themselves rich at your cost. If you only take into account the next 5 minutes of the interaction, surely I can get some advantage by hindering you. But in the long term, it is through having other nations which are free and prosperous that your prosperity will be fueled. So there's a misalignment between short-term and long-term interest. And I think that the wisest people in history have been the ones noticing how it is in the long term that free speech generates the most amount of prosperity by far.
Correct.
I've been thinking quite a bit about a theory I'm developing. I did my best in trying to articulate my ideas back then when I did in this podcast. There's an episode called The Origin of All the Vices and Virtues, in which I argue about how when the benefits of something are tangible and the costs are not, we tend to overindulge in that. And the opposite happens with things like the gym or eating healthily, which the benefits are not tangible, but the costs are. So we tend to underindulge in those things. And I think I've seen so many connections with free speech, because at a societal level,
there's a tragedy of the commons. This is a concept from economics, which means that everyone does what individually is convenient, but it's negative for the collective. And I've seen a connection between the tragedy of the commons and my theory about the origin of vices and virtues, in which you do the thing that is convenient for you, as by not talking truth to power, and everyone does. And so ideas are not subject to a process of natural selection, because everyone does what is convenient for them. And this goes against free speech. And ultimately, who's always opposed to free speech are authoritarians. So that's why I mentioned before that the connection between traditional liberal values and free speech are so, their overlap is huge.
Mm-hmm.
I think that free speech is a hard thing to defend because the benefits are not immediate. You need to have, you have to be able to see more farther than 15 minutes.
Which is why it is so crucial that it's embodied in the Constitution, because support for it isn't intuitive. And a lot of times people in a rage would get rid of it, but it's not easy to get rid of it, a constitutional amendment.
That's like marriage, isn't it? You do not get into marriage because of a short-term convenience.
Yep.
And you wouldn't want to get out of it out of a short-term need to satisfy your most basic instincts.
Yep.
And it is part of being a wise society and a wise individual to embrace some restrictions of your freedom so that when the moment comes, you do not take the wrong decision.
Yeah, well, remember, this is the most diverse society on earth. So we're most in need of a First Amendment because there's more disagreement in this society, more cultural diversity, more religious diversity, racial diversity. If you look around, there isn't a single country that has this kind of diversity. And the reason that's true is because it's a nation of immigrants.
Exactly. And how is it that while we arguably have never had such a diverse, maybe not diverse, but such different opinions on the landscape of politics in the US, let's say, Republicans and Democrats are now as separated in the spectrum of politics as they have ever been?
That's not quite true. We have always had very divergent political views in this country, going from the far right to the far left. What we now have, however, is less tolerance of other views. It is not the diversity of political opinion that has changed in the last 8-9 years. It is the tolerance that each side has for the views of the other, and the notion that people who disagree with us are somehow evil rather than simply, you know, disagree with us. That's what's changed.
Okay, I was coming to my argument from a perspective that after the Second World War, by the fact of having a common enemy, the Nazi Germany, the USSR, and Japan, the population in the US converged a lot in their ideas. So my perspective from what I've read from history is that in the 50s, for example, the amount of overlap between what the Republicans and Democrats believed was huge. The most conservative of the Democrats were more so than the more progressive of the Republicans.
Yeah. Well, there's a look what's happening today. The members of Congress don't agree on much, but they do agree on Ukraine. There is a bilateral support for American support for Ukraine. They don't agree on the budget. They don't agree on cultural issues. They don't agree on racial issues. And they certainly don't agree on economic issues, but there is bilateral support for American weapons being shipped to Ukraine.
Interesting. That's right. I've never thought of that perspective. That's right. I think that ideas, as I mentioned before, have to be subjected to a process analogous to natural selection. And the ethos of my podcast is the purpose of dialogue is to let ideas die instead of us. That's similar to what happens with, for example, China. In China, as you correctly mentioned, due to the nature of the system, they are not incentivized to report their economic situation properly. And they do not. They always over-report in the positive things and they under-report in the negative ones because incentives are not aligned to communicate truth. And in the same way, if you do not subject the smallest region to a natural selection, you do the bigger one. If you not allow the leaves to move, to wiggle with the wind, the trunk will collapse and will crack eventually, because there's no trunk which is infinitely robust. So I think that in the same way that free speech allows ideas to be to disappear and die instead of us, we are the trunk in this analogy, and ideas are the leaves of the tree, not permitting the scientific method and open speech with the perception that this will further your agenda in the short term. I've seen this a lot with the social justice fundamentalists. They are fueled by a lot of Marxism, and those are the major threat to free speech, I believe, in general in the world.
Well, let me tell you, you bring up China. There are a lot of people who think that China is going to pull ahead of us in terms of productivity. It ain't gonna happen, because the system of one rule, especially by one man, even one party rule, but this is not even one party rule, this is one man rule, is going to trip up when that one man makes a huge mistake of judgment, and nobody's going to have the guts to point it out.
Exactly. Also, the demographic. If you see the demographics from China, the one child policy.
They're not having enough children.
Yeah, the one child policy in the 80s and the 90s has caused now to not have.
That's because the government decreed that there was what? Families should have one child because there were too many people, too many mouths to feed. And so you've got the government. It's incredible that the government has intruded into the bedroom the way it has. But it has. I mean, there's no area of life, including sexual relations between husband and wife. There's no area that is protected from government intrusion in China. And that is going to be their downfall.
That seems to me like a more of a religious stance. I'm not claiming that you are religious in any ways, but I'm just saying that I'm incredibly liberal in a traditional manner. I believe that the intervention of the government should only exist in the regions in which the market is shown to have loss. And those are minuscule. Probably around 2% of the GDP could be plenty for the government. But I'm trying to do a bit of devil's advocate, because I see in you something that I see reflected in me a lot, which is that liberal values are something that we advocate for because they have been shown to be the best empirically. You only have to compare Switzerland with Zimbabwe, and you see the evident difference in what economic freedom leads to. But what if the best way to acquire power and prosperity was not that? Is your liberal position coming entirely from an empirical perspective, or is it more of a rationalization of the consequences of liberalism in a longer term than we have experienced? I'm trying to understand whether your position for liberal values comes uniquely from empirical testing, as we've seen comparing, for example, Switzerland and Zimbabwe, or is it that you have been able to understand some logic behind the system which would presumably be applicable to a longer term than we have seen? We do not have evidence for liberal values applied to society for more than, let's say, 1,000 years.
Okay, so your question basically is whether I operate on theory or practical observation?
No. You have a lot of practical observation and a lot of theory. I'm sure of that. There's economic theory which backs the statements. But what I'm trying to argue, and I'm not being successful at eloquently explaining this, and I apologize for it, is that what if there was a superior system in achieving power and prosperity which wasn't maximizing freedom?
What if there was a system that was not free, that achieved more, what, material benefits?
For example, yeah.
Okay, that is simply not going to happen. It is a highly theoretical question that doesn't take historical and current realities into account. Now, my own personal value system is that I think that human freedom is more important than material benefit. However, throughout history, those have not been in conflict with each other. They have been complementary to each other, because from human freedom comes productivity, a free economy. It achieves much more than a managed economy. In some ways, my views are a libertarian. I'm actually a member of the Libertarian Party. I'm an adjunct fellow of the Cato Institute. I think the libertarians have it right. Where I differ from the libertarians is I also believe that society needs to have a floor beyond below which citizens are not allowed to fall. I'm not in favor of a welfare state, but I think, for example, Social Security is a very good idea because it helps people get into their old age after they're no longer able to work. I don't believe, by the way, in retirement, unless one is mentally or physically not fit. I work full time and I'm 81 years old. I have zero intent to ever retire, as long as I'm healthy and my brain is working.
That's beautiful. And I wish more people were like you. Going back to the quest of finding what is correct to be subjected to a process of natural selection or trial and error, or like you said, you state one thesis and the opposite, and from that interaction, truth tends to emerge.
There was a great scientist. You're too young to have remembered him. His name was Carl Sagan. He was a cosmologist. He was at Cornell. He actually was a neighbor of mine because he started his career at Harvard, and I live right in the middle of Harvard. And so Carl Sagan and his wife, Lynn Sagan, Lynn was a very close friend of my late wife, Elsa Dorfman, and they lived about three blocks from here. Anyway, Carl was up, and he went up to Cornell, and he gave a great lecture, and I was privileged to have gotten a recording of the lecture. The lecture was entitled Science and Civil Liberties. And Sagan posited the following: the reason free speech is the best system ever devised by mankind. And of course, nowadays you can't even say mankind, you have to say peoplekind. Otherwise, you get hit by the feminists. You know, everyone's going nuts in this country. The reason scientific free speech is so important is he analogizes the scientific method. The scientific method is you do experiments and you see what's working and what doesn't work. If one combination of chemicals doesn't work to cure a disease, you try another combination of chemicals. You experiment and eventually you come across the right combination. That's scientific method. That's how it works. Experiments. Okay. Carl Sagan said human society is the same. You try different forms of government. You try different laws. You try different regulations, different formulations to see what works. And if you're not free to try everything, then you do not end up with the winner, with the winning combination. So he analogizes free speech to scientific method, and he's right on. That's exactly why it works so well. If you're in Russia and Putin decides how he's going to operate, how he's going to run his war in Ukraine. If Russia was a free society, they would have overrun Ukraine in 3 weeks. But Ukraine is free. Russia is not. Putin has made mistake after mistake after mistake after mistake. Plus, because there's no free press, Russia is hopelessly corrupt. And the armed forces that they spend a lot of money on, a lot of that is siphoned off in corruption. So Russia is kind of a hollowed out society that had great potential, but has been destroyed by dictatorship. Ukraine, one third the size, has held off now for a year and a third, and the experts now believe Ukraine's gonna win the war. Unheard of, unimaginable, but not unimaginable for anybody who understood the benefits of a free society.
Not allowing the small fluctuations to occur forces the system to reverberate in a bigger way. This happens with a lot of systems, and Nassim Taleb has more eloquently talked about this than I could. I would like to know whether the scientific method you mentioned should be itself subjected to the scientific method? Should we do some trial and error with something which is scientific and then something which is not, sort of applying to scientific method to the scientific method itself? Or should we take the scientific method as a dogma?
Well, scientific method is a modality. It's a way of approaching things. It's the scientific equivalent of free speech, where you try everything. So scientific method, anybody who tries to get rid of scientific method is getting rid of freedom and everyone and creativity and progress and everything else.
Yeah, but where I was going with this question is that we could also try with an alternative to science in a scientific way to test whether it's superior or not. And we have been shown thousands of times that it is not. But my question is, in the same way that we have a ethical value hierarchy in our lives, and we live by it, and we do not subject the thing at the top of it, because if we did, we would have nothing to build from. And we have to accept something as at a certain level of dogma, because there's always something which you cannot justify. The justification you use to justify everything else is not itself justified by anything. It's turtles all the way down.
Are you talking about values?
I'm trying to draw an analogy between values, free speech, and the scientific method. And I'm trying to see whether the scientific method should be itself subject to the scientific method. And what I mean by this is that with the other analogy I talked about values, the thing at the top of it, let's say in my case, is human flourishing. I really care about human flourishing. That's the thing I want to maximize. And below that, we find that free speech, the scientific method, and open inquiry in general maximizes human flourishing. So that's why I like it. But there's always a presupposition which is itself not justified by anything else. At the top of the hierarchy of values, you've got something which is itself not justified. The thing at the top can justify the things at the bottom.
You mean it's like the starting point?
Yeah.
Okay. So what's your question about the starting point? That is not subject to scientific method?
Exactly.
Well, of course it is. It's subject to the rule of success. If your starting principle produces successes all the way down, then you know that your starting principle is correct. So it is subject to verification.
Interesting.
The only thing that is not subject to verification are religious views. Religion is in a whole different category. Now, I believe I'm an absolutist with respect to freedom of religion as well as speech. Religion is in the category of belief that is not based on provable. It's not based on data. It cannot be proven or disproven. You believe in God, there is no proof of it. It is faith. Faith is very different. A free society stays peaceful if people do not dictate to other people what they may or may not believe.
Sure. But what I was referring to is that why we care at all about human flourishing is itself a question which cannot be responded.
Well, that's a value. That's a value. It's not different than religion. It's a value. It's like this is a society that believes in the dignity of the individual. The individual is not, you're not on earth in order to serve me. I'm not on earth to serve you. If I decide to do you a favor or you decide to do me a favor, that's fine. But we're not obligated. In a free society, I'm obligated not to punch you in the nose. I'm obligated not to cheat you. But I'm not obligated to love you. I'm not obligated to help you. I'm certainly not obligated to make you feel good about yourself. That's one of my bugaboos, you know, now that, you know, in schools, they want to make students feel good about themselves. Well, screw that. Schools are for educating. They're not to make you feel great. Drives me crazy. That really drives me nuts.
But arguably, just to do some devil's advocate here, without positive feedback in the internal reward mechanism of the kid, learning could not occur. If the kid is not enjoying the learning, there's no learning.
Correct.
We have to give the devil its due. And in some way, it is true that you have to make the kid feel good in order to allow learning. But that doesn't mean that you have to be, the way the school has to be organized can be chosen on a centralized manner. That doesn't justify authoritarianism.
Well, it's like the old adage about, you know, raising children. You get more if you reward a child with a piece of candy than if you punish him by whipping him. I mean, that's just human nature, and that's gotten from experience.
I wonder, you're a lawyer, you've got a lot of experience dealing with the courts and the legal system, and with your political opinions, I would like to know what your thoughts are on the following question. Where does the right to privacy collide with the public interest, like finding out where a terrorist resides?
Okay, well, now you're talking about where the public interest supervenes, where it is more important than the private interest. And the way our society has solved that in the legal system is you cannot do something that hurts somebody else unless you have a supervening right. Now, for example, if you come at me with a knife, I have a right to shoot you. I have a right to throw something at you. I have a right to use jujitsu to try to disable you. But that's only if you're coming at me with a weapon. If you're not coming at me with a weapon, I have no right to violate your space.
So there has to be some proportionality in the response.
You call it proportionality. Maybe that's what it is. I call it perspective, but it's sort of the same thing.
Okay. Yeah. And I entirely agree with you. And it seems to me like it is incredibly convenient that there's an alignment between societal fear, how much the population fears, and the government's quest for power. And this has been seen in every instance in which the government could have done something to instill much more fear into society.
Let me give you an example. You're in your 20s, I assume.
I'm 21, yeah.
Okay. So I lived through an era when gay sex was a felony. Okay? A felony. And I was on the board of the ACLU of Massachusetts. I was president of the board for 2 years. We litigated, we lectured, we agitated for the abolition of these laws. It was none of my business if two men got together and had anal intercourse. That was not my business, as long as it was voluntary and not forced. It was a felony in Massachusetts for two men or two women to have sexual relations. We finally got those laws declared unconstitutional under the state constitution. A couple years later, the U.S. Supreme Court declared them unconstitutional under the federal constitution. The same thing with gay marriage. Marriage was lawful between two men or two women in Massachusetts before it was protected by the U.S. Supreme Court. We have an older constitution than the U.S. Constitution. We have a Bill of Rights on which the federal Bill of Rights is patterned. And so we were the pioneers here. And I said the Civil Liberties Union, in an era when it really was a Civil Liberties Union, it's much more of a progressive organization now, but it was a real Civil Liberties organization. Who somebody slept with was none of our business. And that's the point. What John Stuart Mill called self-regarding conduct. Any conduct that doesn't hurt somebody else should be lawful. There's no reason for religion or taste to govern, you know, my behavior or your behavior.
I'm not being able to understand where the connection with the alignment between the people's fears. I could give a lot of examples, a lot of historical examples in which this has happened. I think there's an alignment, and I do not, maybe you misunderstood my question, but I think what I was referring to before is that there's an alignment between the fear in the population and the government's quest for power. The government, if he can, will instill some fear in the population so that he can say, hey, give me some more power so that I can protect you. And that is the origin of most, if not all, of authoritarian governments.
Well, look, that's how Hitler started. You know, the Reichstag fire. I mean, this is a technique of dictators forever. Create a panic and then say that, oh, you can protect people from these dangers. Spare me from, you know, this kind of protection. It's just what we don't need. That's why it's so important for free societies to educate children in self-reliance. You should not be depending on a government where you don't need the government.
And how do you distinguish between an instance in which the fear is justified and one in which it is entirely a propagandistic movement by the government?
You know how? By thinking. That's what the human brain is for. Distinguishing two situations.
There's a trade-off between skepticism and relying on other people's opinions. Because skepticism, arguably, is vital for the scientific method.
There's also a difference between skepticism and cynicism, but we won't get into that.
Yeah, entirely. Okay. You're 100% right. There are some instances in which skepticism is not justified. But this is something I would love to develop further. What would be your advice for a young man like me, or a human being more in general, for how to distinguish when it is appropriate to use one of the two sides of the same sword of finding truth, which is skepticism in one side and relying on other people's opinion? The two have to be used a lot.
Let me tell you what you rely on is experience. I have had a lot more. I'm 81. I have had a lot more experience than you have. You will, each year of your life, you will accumulate more experience. Experience is really, going back to Carl Sagan, scientific method. Experience is trying things and seeing what works. What works for you. Sometimes there's objective tests of what works. For example, if you have a headache, you might take an aspirin. What you don't bother taking is a gumdrop. Why? Experience has shown that aspirin works on curing headaches and gumdrops don't. So experience, and that's what science is all about, trying things and seeing what works. So experience, that the reason I know a lot more than you do, the reason I have better judgment on some things than you do, the reason I can do some things better than you, is because I'm so much older. On the other hand, there are things you can do better than me because you're younger, you're more vigorous. You can probably lift weights that I left. Now, I work out every day with weights, but I was able to lift a lot more 30 years ago than I am now. Oh, that's all right, but I'm in pretty good shape because I lift weights every day and I haven't allowed myself to deteriorate. It will happen at some point, but it ain't happening yet. I can assure you I will last through this interview.
Yeah, it's remarkable how some people are able to maintain their health longer than others. And in a big proportion, that's due to sport, to doing exercise.
And I work. I also think that working full time is very good. The idea of retirement is such a bad idea. Some societies in France now, they're having riots because the government wants people to work to, what is the age, 68 or something like that? You're young at 68, for God's sakes. It's crazy.
But that's the natural outcome of the intervention of the government. When the government intervenes, it breaks incentives and it turns everyone into a parasite.
Correct. Imagine having a set retirement age for an entire society where some people are fit into their 90s. There are professors who continue to teach in their 90s. They've had enormous experience. They get better. They don't get worse. It's not like they're doing manual labor.
I'm incredibly interested in the concept of intelligence. And I think you are hitting the nail here in that experience allows you to recognize patterns in a more efficient way because you've seen a lot of them.
Well, you know, I'm a lawyer and I now can intuit defenses much faster than I could when I was a 25-year-old lawyer.
Exactly.
Because I've had this experience. Would you rather have, you needed an operation, a brain operation. Would you rather have a doctor where you're the third operation he's done or the 3,000th operation he's done? That's a no-brainer. You want the guy with the experience. Surgery is a particular art that gets better with age until you get too old to do the surgery. Well, you know, your stamina, you know, some of these surgical procedures are 6 hours. You have to be able to stand on your feet and operate on somebody's brain for 6 hours. That takes stamina. You're not going to do that when you're 80, but you do it when you're 48, 50, 55. You've had an enormous amount of experience and you're still young enough to have vigor.
Yeah. What you are referring to before in the things that you are able to do better than I can is the experience you've built through decades. And I've recently read a book called On Intelligence by Jeff Hawkins. He's a neuroscientist and he believes that intelligence is basically pattern recognition. You recognize a pattern and you build a prediction of what will happen in the future. And you have a much better predictive system than I do in a lot of the cases because you've been exposed to a lot more empirical evidence than I have. And I couldn't have built the internal representations of the patterns that you have. And that is intelligence in some way. Even if the fluid IQ in your case is lower than it was in your case 60 years ago, because that's a fact of how the brain works, the ability, the crystallized intelligence in your case is massive in comparison to that of 60 years ago.
That's the reason when I ran my own law firm, I always hired a lot of young lawyers. So the firm had a combination of young lawyers, middle-aged lawyers, and older lawyers. Because between all those groups, you had a much better team than if everybody was the same age.
Interesting. So you get the fluid intelligence of the younger people who are able to cognitively go through much more content
Correct.
Per second.
I have research assistants. I have always had research assistants. These are people who have gotten out of college. They're thinking of going to law school. They work for me for a year or two or three years. I was told that I was the first lawyer in the country who started this. We call them paralegals. They have not gone to start law school. They're thinking of it. They want a year or two of experience. And I have had hundreds of paralegals working with me over the decades. And the paralegal experiences by getting a view of what law practice is like. And I benefit by getting the perspective of somebody in their early 20s, somebody like you. I would hire you in a second if you were here in Cambridge.
Oh, really?
Sure.
Well, that's a big compliment.
Where are you located geographically?
San Sebastian.
Where?
I live in San Sebastian, a small city in the north of Spain.
Okay, well, I can't hire you.
Yeah. I've noticed that the ex-president of Harvard, Larry Summers, was forced to resign due to communicating a statistical truth, which is that the IQ of males has a lot more variance than that of females. It doesn't have a difference in average, but it does in variance.
I'm personally familiar with the Larry Summers situation. He's a friend of mine. Larry Summers was forced out of the presidency of Harvard, even though he's brilliant, brilliant, brilliant. He was forced out because he gave a lecture in which he pointed out that women were less prominent in science than men. Now, there were women in the audience who interpreted this as some are saying that they're less competent in science. That wasn't what he was saying. He was making the point that women don't have the opportunities that men have. Science was a field at the time that was assumed to be a man's field, okay, rather than equal opportunity. But he was forced out because the women interpreted it as him saying that women scientists are not as good as male scientists. That wasn't what he said. I read the speech. And so he was forced out. And a woman was elected as president of Harvard. Let me tell you that she was not nearly as good as Larry Summers, but he was replaced by a woman who was inferior, not because she was a woman, but because she was inferior, true Faust. And since then, every Harvard president has walked on tiptoes, very careful about what he or she says, because you don't want to say something that's going to get people upset with you. Well, what kind of a president of Harvard can you be if you don't get people upset with you? It means you're not saying anything. It means you're a bureaucrat.
Exactly. And I think that he had three main arguments during his speech. One of them was the biological basis for a bigger variance in almost all the traits, height, aggression, IQ. There's a lot of factors in which almost all of them have a bigger variability in the bell curve distribution among men than among women. Because this has a lot of evolutionary biology behind it. It's more profitable for evolution to throw the dice with men than with women, because one man can spread its genes across many women, but one woman cannot do so with many men. That's probably the reason of it. So that was one of the arguments. Another one was the difference in tastes. Women are more interested in people on average, and men are more interested in things, and science tends to be more thing concentrated than other fields. And I think that there was another one, which was discrimination, but he downplayed its role, and this was what made people be hijacked.
Yeah, well, see, people, in my view, were equal in rights. They're not equal in skills. Not every brain works as well as another brain. Some people are more skilled with their hands. I can't knock a nail in a piece of wood without chopping my finger off. That isn't my thing. Everybody has things that they're good at. We all have the same rights, but we don't all have the same talents. We don't all have the same IQ. And so equality is a legal concept, equality of rights. It is not a biological concept. Men are different than women, like the French say, and vive la différence. Men are different than women, generally. That doesn't mean there aren't exceptions, that there are some women who have skills that usually men have, and men have skills that usually women have. But there are gender differences. They don't affect rights. They affect realities.
Exactly. And anyone who knows something about statistics knows that a difference in variance creates a huge difference in the tails. The amount of people above 160 in IQ are predominantly male.
Yes.
Not because males are more intelligent. They are also predominant below 40 in IQ. And those are a small minority. But when the variance is a bit bigger, that's where the huge differences at the tails of the distribution come. And this was one of the points he was making. I'm drilling into this topic a lot because I think it goes to this root of the problem here. There's some subjects which cannot be touched because they are believed that if we accept any nuance that goes against the general narrative, all progress will be lost. And this is false because truth has to always precede anything else. We have to be finding truth. And if it is uncomfortable, deal with it. It is not my problem that something is true or not. It's just something I have to deal with.
Mm-hmm. And of course, some things are not subject to proof factually. Religious views, for example, are not subject to scientific proof one way or the other. And we respect a person's religious views. And throughout history, millions of people have been murdered because they didn't accept somebody else's religious view. We had the Crusades. So we have learned the hard way that there are some areas that are not subject to scientific proof. There's no right and wrong. A lot of people don't have any religious views at all. And we have not had religious warfare in the Western world for quite a while, but it's still going on. There's religious warfare in other parts of the world in which people are killing one another over religious differences. It's astounding.
I think that there's a quote I really like. I first heard it from one of my favorite podcasters, Chris Williamson. He said, "The complexity of the truth is inconvenient for both sides." And this is so right.
Yep.
Both conservatives and liberals have something right, but neither of them wants to admit that they also have something wrong. Why would truth be perfectly aligned with one of the sides? That doesn't make sense to me.
It doesn't make sense to you because it doesn't make sense.
Okay, I appreciate that. I think that there's a societal mechanism which promotes dogmatism. I think this has a lot to do with unconditionality. We are prone to seeking for unconditionality in our partners, in our friends. We do not want to see other people defect us when a short-term benefit arises for them. So we want to see some unconditionality in them. I'm here for you, no matter what, and I will keep being here. That instinct that we have to show unconditionality is mistaken and maladaptively applied to ideas. And people who are, to give one example, because I think this is predominantly where most of the censorship comes from, which is the left, social justice fundamentalists believe that ascribing to their opinions in an unconditional manner, not looking at evidence at all, is virtuous because you are signaling unconditionality. But unconditionality should be given to people, not ideas, and maybe not even people.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think of this perspective? Do you think the natural instinct we have to seek unconditionality has a lot to do with the tendency we have?
You mean absolutes?
Yeah. We tend to believe the seeking of unconditionality in each other is wrongly applied to ideas. And so people believe to be virtuous by not questioning the general narrative. And this happens a lot with social justice fundamentalism.
Yeah. Well, I think it's very bad to not question. I think it's very bad not to question things that are really determined by values. And I would apply the scientific method to those kinds of subjective things. What works and what doesn't, what produces a more harmonious society, what produces a more successful and fulfilling life. I think all this is subject to the test. It's not subject to the same kind of scientific method that Carl Sagan talked about. He was in favor of applying scientific method to beliefs, belief systems as well, what works and what doesn't work. That's what he meant by scientific method. That's what he was talking about, civil liberties aspects. Free speech to Sagan meant scientific method. You applied the same tests, what works and what doesn't work. And that's the way I like to operate. And I certainly do it in my law practice, but I do it in personal life as well. I happen to be married. I was with my wife for 53 years before she died of kidney failure. We were together for 53. That's a long time in an era today, you know, of quick divorce. But it worked because empirically it worked. It helped that I was a lawyer and she was a photographer. We weren't in the same field. That helped.
What advice would you give to young people looking for a successful marriage?
What's my advice about marriage?
What advice could you give me?
Okay. Marry somebody who is in a completely different work field than you are. And that avoids competition. Husbands and wives should not be partners in what they do. They should be in completely separate fields. My wife was a portrait photographer. I'm a lawyer. So that's number one. I also believe, and this irks some people who have religious views that conflict with it, I believe that a man and a woman, or two men or two women, should live together for a few years before they get married. Because I think that the compatibility is something that doesn't appear in a month or 2 months. It appears if the 3 years or so. Now, this to religious people, this is considered sin because they shouldn't have sex before you're married. Well, if that's your religious view, good luck to you. But it's not conducive to strong relationships if you can't have some life experience together before you decide to legalize, to formalize the relationship. So Elsa and I, we started to live together in the second year that we knew each other, and we lived together for 7 years before we decided to have a child. Now, she was already she was 39, so we couldn't wait much longer. I was 5 years younger than she. That's a very personal issue, but I was very happy I married an older woman. I thought that it worked very well. Obviously worked well. We were together for 53 years. But you know, these are all very personal things. What works for one person may not work for another. My son married an only child as well. His wife is an only child, but neither of them particularly like being only children, so they have two. There's nothing wrong with being an only child. And the only child, I don't know if this is within the ambit of what you want to interview me on, but I'll give you some life advice, okay? Only children become part of the marriage. If you have two children, they entertain or they fight or they work together. They're interested more in each other than they are in the parents. But if you have one child, the child becomes part of your partner. Now, my son, I used to take him into the office. I used to take him to court with me. He learned what I did because my wife, I had an arrangement. I took care of him half the week and she took care of him half the week. When she was young and being breastfed, she lugged him to California because she had a photographic show in California. So she lugged this kid on the plane. She had to take him because he was breastfeeding. That's something I couldn't do. So I would take him to court. He, at a very young age, he understood what the legal system was about because he went to court with me. He went to the office with me. So I believe that parents of only children, that it's inevitable that that child becomes part of the marriage. When you have two or more kids, they fight with each other, they work with each other, they play with each other, but they leave the parents alone. An only child doesn't leave the parents alone.
Yeah. I am an only child.
You're an only child? Congratulations, then you've understood what I'm talking about.
I see a strong analogy between your approach to marriage and the scientific method, in that by living with your partner for a few years before getting married, you allow to weed out the losses, to cut the losses early.
And that's seen as immoral by highly religious people. But, you know, it works. First of all, it's not immoral. It depends on your moral code. But to me, it really is important. And it's a very important life lesson.
What do you think about nuance and how it is fervently opposed by people who do not accept or want freedom of speech? Generally, lack of taste for freedom of speech, authoritarianism, dogmatism, and lack of nuance acceptance are all, there's a huge overlap.
Yeah, people are entitled to be in their own groups. If you want to be in a group that doesn't believe in free speech, you can do that. And you can hold your tongue and expect others around you to hold their tongues. As long as you don't insist that I operate according to your code, I'm fine with that.
Could we be tolerant towards the intolerant?
Sure, as long as the intolerant don't infringe on our space, of course.
But that would make them tolerant towards you.
Yeah, well, look, I could never be a Catholic priest for a lot of reasons. Number one, I'm an agnostic. I'm not a believer. Number two, the idea of never having any relations with, physical relations with a woman, does not particularly entice me. So religiously, culturally, this is not the life for me. Do I believe that Catholic priests should be allowed to be priests? Of course. They have their own interesting lives, but it's different than mine.
So in the moment someone wants to impose to you their way of living, that's where you would oppose it fervently.
Yes, they've crossed the Maginot line, yeah.
So there's no tolerance with the intolerant.
Correct. Yeah, you have to be intolerant of intolerance.
And tolerant of other tolerances.
Correct.
That's something that a lot of the constructivists do not get. They say, oh yeah, but there's no truth. Okay, but is that claim itself true?
Well, let me point out, truth in the non-scientific arena is relative. You have your truth, I have my truth. I don't have the hubris to believe that my beliefs are truth. I only have the hubris to believe that they work for me. I know what works for me. I've had 81 years to figure out what works for me. I don't know you well enough to know what works for you. If you lived in Cambridge, Massachusetts, we'd know each other better.
I've noticed that previous to the 1950s, academic journals were not as formal. They were more searching for truth than statements of truth. And I see an analogy with the legal system. And please correct me if you believe I'm wrong. I believe that in the legal system, there's a lot of self-perpetuating in the sense of writing the laws deliberately in a complex manner so that the intelligent people who know the law and who have written it are more necessary for the rest of the people and so perpetuate their own positions.
Okay, let me give you a little law lecture, okay? Sit back and relax. First of all, our system is based on the English common law. What is the English common law? It is law that developed in England that was unwritten, not legislated by the parliament, not dictated by the king, unwritten, based upon experience. So, for example, the law of contract, there were rules developed that if we had a business transaction, we drew up a contract in which payment was specified, the duties of each side were specified. It provided for clarity. That law was unwritten. It wasn't passed by parliament. It was experience. There was a great Supreme Court Justice, Oliver Wendell Holmes, who said that I forget the exact quote, but he said, you know, the law is not dictum, is not dictated, it is experience. Experience, he said, is the heart of the law. What works, works. What doesn't work is tossed aside. So tort law, torts are personal wrongs. If I punch you in the nose, that's a tort. If I trip you, that's a tort. The personal interactions where somehow it's considered wrong, not productive, and not good for human relations. Those are torts, sort of civil wrongs that don't rise to the level of a crime, but they're not nice. They're not useful for human society. Contracts are agreements between people, and the law requires that you fulfill your obligations in a contract. All of this happened before any of this was put down in writing. The law was developed by court opinions interpreting these common law principles. It's why the common law system has worked so well for so many centuries. The common law is still the law in Massachusetts and 49 other states. The only state that differs is Louisiana that uses the French code. But the common law has worked for centuries because of experience, okay? It's the same with friendships. It's the same with marriages. People say marriage as long as experience indicates you're compatible. You stay friends with somebody as long as you know you can trust them, as long as they're helpful to you and they like you or they love you. I have friends who have been my friends for 50 years. I love them. They love me. These are relationships that have proven themselves over time. Holmes was absolutely right. That experience is more important than theory. What works, works. What doesn't work, doesn't work.
Do you see a connection between the increase in the complexity of the vocabulary used in the journals from the 1950s until now and the way law is written in that by deliberately writing things in a more complex manner? You make people who are going to interpret those writings more dependent on you.
Yeah. Well, first of all, if you're a cynic, you believe that a lot of laws are made more complex than they have to be in order to give lawyers work. And in some instances, that's correct. That's true. Remember, most of the members of the legislature are lawyers. This is not good. So I believe that life is too complex. I believe that the laws and regulations are too complex. Everything is subject to. I wrote a book called Three Felonies a Day, How the Feds Target the Innocent. And my thesis was that federal laws are intentionally made vague so that people end up violating them without even knowing it. And my thesis was that the average American engages in three felonies a day and doesn't even know it. And that's because the laws are so complex. The laws are between human relations and the laws of commercial relations and the government regulations. I believe that we should have in this country a vast, vast simplification of the law so that common, ordinary people can understand what their legal obligations are. Now this is even hitting an area in which this has become really endemic, is on campuses. I represent a lot of students, and there are a lot of students who are charged with sexual impropriety, okay? Now, the problem is two students get together and they have sex. In a lot of cases, the woman or the man or one of the partners claims it was not consensual. Well, the problem is you don't really have evidence of whether it was or wasn't because there are only two people there, okay? And so this is a quintessential area for false accusation. Quintessential, the woman decides the next morning that she didn't like the guy and that the sex was forced. So she brings a rape charge. And he said, well, wait a minute. We were having a good time. It was clearly consensual. There's only two people there. So it's he said, she said. A lot of false accusations, some true accusations, but a lot of false accusations come in the sex area for exactly the reason I'm saying, that there are no witnesses. Now, there aren't that many college students who have threesomes where there's a third person there.
There's a fundamental difference between regret and rape.
Correct.
And noticing the difference is the job of the judicial system.
Yeah. I mean, it's a huge problem in the society now where there's a tendency to translate regret into lack of consent, into unwillingness. You know, how could I have let this thug, I didn't voluntarily into sexual relations with this thug. I must have been coerced.
You are not. And that is your responsibility.
In one school, I really am a student of how schools handle these things. One school, there's some fucking idiot dean decided that before a couple, whether it's two men, two women, or a man and a woman, had sex, they should sign an agreement that it was voluntary. Well, can you imagine in the heat of passion suddenly saying, oh, we got to now enter into a contract, so here's my pad. This isn't how it happens. This isn't how it happens. You don't have to be 81 years old to understand this. These deans should have their heads examined. Anyway, don't get me started on college administrators.
I want to share with you a quote from Nassim Taleb. A bureaucracy is a system by which the consequences of their acts are conveniently separated from the people who make decisions. And that is exactly what is required for this stupid idea to be enacted. If someone has no interaction with the real world, and it's just idealizing and has no empirical evidence, you could say, okay, it would be lovely if we had a form of consent, which you have to write and explicitly sign that, okay, I'm going to have sex with this person, I'm happy to do that, and let's have someone check that I'm actually writing this over my free will.
Yeah, it's sort of like it turns it into a commercial transaction. I mean, it's so unrealistic. And again, they don't have any idea of the role of passion in human interactions.
How much money does it go to college administrations?
College administrators now outnumber college teachers. I would say that about 40% of the cost of a college education is to pay administrators. And they're not only useless, but they're harmful to the enterprise. I'm currently a candidate for the Harvard Board of Overseers. My platform is to fire 95% of the administrators, reduce tuition by 40%. That gets rid of speech codes, kangaroo courts, and all the interferences that deans impose on the life of an undergraduate. It would improve the educational system. It would improve the social system. It would vastly improve intimate relations between college students. because you wouldn't have the dean, you know, determining who's on top and who's on bottom. I mean, it drives me absolutely nuts.
Could you do a steel man of how a college administrator would justify its position?
I believe that administrators should help organize courses and classes, should, you know, keep that straight, should make sure that the student health service is well staffed with competent medical people, should make sure that the library works well, that you can get access to the books and other resources, should head the buildings and grounds so that the grass is green rather than parched. There are roles for administrators. None of it involves interactions among students. That is not the role of an administrator. And violence among students, that's against the law. You don't need administrators to deal with that.
It is hard to make a man understand something when his salary depends on his not understanding it.
Yeah. Well, for example, in sexual assault cases, my view is if a man or a woman thinks that he or she has been sexually assaulted, report it to the police. Let the justice system work it out. Don't report it to the dean. I remember cases in which the deans would love to hear the details. They were actually stimulated by listening to the details of lovemaking sessions among undergraduates. I mean, you got some real kind of perverse outcomes of the role of the dean. I had a case in which I was charged with my client was charged with sexual assault. The dean was hearing the case, and the woman was there, and the dean was asking the most intimate questions for the woman to describe exactly what happened. And I could see that the dean was sort of getting stimulated by listening. It was almost as if it was a pornography session. I mean, real crazy stuff over the notion that the dean should have any role whatsoever in the intimate relations among students. I say, if you claim you're raped, go to the district attorney. There's a system that actually works pretty well to determine when it's voluntary and when it isn't. But don't go to some voyeur dean who is asking you, you know, well, and then where did he put his penis? You know, that's none of your damn business, Mr. Dean. I mean, I used to go nuts at these hearings.
And they violate the presumption of innocence.
They violate your privacy as well as the presumption of innocence. I mean, students are entitled to privacy, and sexual relations are among the most private area of our culture. Sexual relations, religious beliefs, these are things that are in here and here. They're not the business of administrators.
Do you know Brett Weinstein?
Who?
Brett Weinstein.
No. Should I?
Yeah, I think you would highly like this person. He's an evolutionary biologist. He was originally from Evergreen College there in California. And he was fired due to the Black Lives Matter movement. He opposed change in the norms they were trying to pass, which was there was a day in the year in which Black people didn't attend to the school to leave evident how important they are for the school, because they are a big percentage of the school and they are a big percentage of the important things that are done at the college and at the country. And they tried to change the norm, or they tried to put another norm which said, okay, now there will be another day in which only Black people will attend the school. And you white people will not attend. And that's where Brett Weinstein opposed the movement, and he was fired.
Yeah, we fought a civil war over these issues in this country. Let me tell you another story. When I was doing research for my first book, The Shadow University, The Betrayal of Liberty in American Education on America's Campuses, I did a tour of various colleges around the country. And I got to a place, I'm trying to remember, it was right outside of Chicago. I don't remember, I'll remember the name of the school in a minute. Hamline University, right? And I was there for freshman orientation. This was the freshman orientation. The trainer, as they call this idiot, lined the students up, had the students line up according to their skin color. The whitest skin, the lightest skin, the blonde, blue-eyed Caucasians, they went in. And then gradually the skin got darker, the hair got darker, and then you had the darkest African Americans, the ones whose ancestors had not yet intermarried with any whites, on the right side. And the exercise was that the student was supposed to recite in front of people that the student was meeting for the first time, mind you, okay? These were not intimate friends. How your race has either benefited or not benefited, was burdened your life so far. The idea behind the trainer's idea was race is destiny in a racist country, okay? That was his idea. Now, I thought to myself, if I was with people that I was seeing for the first time, I would not want them to know about my intimate views about my views about race just yet. I don't even know these people. I haven't had a meal with these people. I thought it was a terrible violation of the privacy and individual conscience of these students to force them to talk about. That's a fairly intimate area of life. You know, maybe not as intimate as sex, but it's fairly intimate. Your views about race, how your race is hindered or not hindered or helped. And it was, to me, shocking that a dean would do this and would be allowed to do this.
Affirmative action, putting people into some positions or decreasing the level of requirement of performance for certain collectives, is itself racist. It's the same flaw we thought we had transcended. You think that you have overcome a problem, which is racism, and you become racist in trying to solve it. That's stupid.
It is counterproductive, it's stupid, and it's unlawful, in my opinion.
Affirmative action doesn't only apply to races. It also happens with sexes. And it's sexist in the sense that it privileges one of the sexes.
Well, I'll tell you the worst thing about affirmative action. It allows institutions to not improve. For example, take admissions, affirmative action of admissions. The reason in the United States Black students need affirmative actions is because they have attended piss poor high schools and elementary schools. The elementary schools have not educated them properly. A kid whose parents have gone to college, the parents help educate the kid. They work with the kid on the homework, for example. Students whose parents never even graduated high school, they don't have that kind of help at home. So they're at a disadvantage. And colleges, instead of working to make high schools better, lower the standards for people from what's called disadvantaged communities, which in this country is almost invariably associated with race. And that gives these students an inferiority complex as well. It essentially says that you could be a brilliant Black kid and suffer from the notion that you got into Harvard because of your skin color. It is the ultimate insult. And I am for abolishing affirmative action and improving high schools and elementary schools.
So before, the argument was you didn't get into Harvard because of your skin color. And now it is you got into Harvard because of your skin color. That's equally nasty.
If slavery was a badge of inferiority, affirmative action is a badge of inferiority.
I love that quote.
You could be a brilliant Black kid and people looking at you saying, oh, I know how you got into Harvard. It doesn't matter that you got 800 on your college boards. You're considered to be inferior. It's a badge of inferiority. Terrible, terrible.
To the best of my knowledge, Harvard is the college which has been the least influenced by this bullshit socialist propaganda. Am I right?
Less influenced? Not true. The Harvard case is in the Supreme Court now. Affirmative action at Harvard is rampant, and it was challenged, and it's in the Supreme Court now. And I believe affirmative action is going to be declared unconstitutional any day now.
What are your prospect becoming head of the Harvard Board of Overseers?
Well, I'll tell you one of the things that I wanted to do here in Cambridge. I am against affirmative action, and I think that Harvard should give special scholarships to its students to get those students to act as tutors for kids of disadvantaged families whose parents do not have a sufficient education to help them with homework. I would give stipends to Harvard students to go into the homes of kids whose parents can't help them with homework and help those kids with their homework. That would really make a difference.
How probable do you think it is you will win the election?
It's improbable because they've stacked the deck against the petition candidates. But this is I'm still going to try.
The by default candidates, if I'm not wrong, were a few of them, and you were not in that list?
Yeah. Here's the story. This is my second time running. I ran in 2011, I think it was. In order to get on the ballot, I needed about 300 signatures of Harvard graduates. I easily did that. I got on the ballot. Then the Harvard Alumni Association sent out the resumes and the platforms of the officially nominated candidates. When I learned about that, I asked them to send my position paper out to the alumni. They refused. They said they only do that for the official candidates. Despite that, I nearly won. So I decided this year I was going to run again. Guess how many signatures I needed? Previously, it was about 300. Guess how many I needed?
More than double.
3,000. They had upped the ante so that people like me wouldn't run again. Isn't that something? It's called candidate suppression.
Something similar occurs at the bipartisan level. The bipartisan system you have in the US, all the other alternatives are hindered by the subsidies given to the parties to do their electoral propaganda. That's one of the ways by which they do so. And the same thing is occurring at Harvard, as I see.
Yes.
You build a huge wall of entrance so no one can get into it.
Correct.
That's nasty. It shouldn't be the case.
I know. Tell me about it.
But how is it that that happened? How is it that people are not noticing this fraud?
Well, you know, the people who run Harvard, it's a very closed little group. And they want to keep outsiders out. What more can I tell you?
Yeah. Authoritarians do not want freedom of speech. They want freedom from opposing speech.
Yep. They don't want, was it the great Nat Hentoff said in this country, they don't want freedom for the thought they hate.
And it's precisely for that thought that you should fight the most for.
Correct.
The purpose of achieving freedom of speech is not so that you can talk. It's so that we build something that transcends my being in power and your being in power, so that when I'm in power, you can talk. When you are in power, I can talk. It's something that transcends you or me. It's something bigger. Mm-hmm. And not noticing this is the origin of not appreciating the vital role of freedom of speech.
Yep.
There was a quote from Brett Weinstein I would like to share with you. It was, "Sometimes during moments like these, it's difficult to figure out the right side of history. But the people on the wrong side of history are always the ones calling for censorship."
Yes. If you're able to ever get a hold of a book by Nat Hentoff, H-E-N-T-O-F-F, you should read it.
Which book?
All of his books were about freedom of speech. With the exception of one book, he was a jazz critic. He has a book on jazz. But otherwise, his best book is Free Speech for Me, But Not for Thee.
I'm searching it. What do you think is the role of meritocracy?
It is how a society functions and makes progress. If you don't pick out the people who really are the best at what they do, the smartest, the hardest workers, you're going to have a society that's engineered by the mediocre people, or worse, by the idiots. So meritocracy is very important for human progress. The whole notion of affirmative action goes against meritocracy. That's why it's so problematic. and it's going to be declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court any day now.
Are you aware of the psychological research relating to IQ?
Well, IQ, I am familiar with it. IQ is an interesting concept because it's an attempt to gauge intelligence, and a lot depends on how you define intelligence. And that's the problem. There are several types of intelligence. There's the intelligence of the ability to do math and physics, science, in other words. There is another type of intelligence, the intelligence of intuition, which is a kind of intelligence. There are people who are very skilled at math. There are others who are skilled at music. There are others who are skilled at woodwork. How do you equate intelligence with skill? IQ tests are very controversial because they measure a particular type of human intelligence, but not every type of human intelligence.
I don't think they do. How can you explain with what you just said about multiple intelligences and cognitive abilities with the fact that there's a huge correlation between all the different things we value at a psychological level? People with higher vocabularies tend to have a higher verbal agility, tend to be better at math, tend to be even better looking, and tend to be more developed sooner.
Let me ask you this. Do you think intelligence has anything to do with the ability to play a piano?
Yes.
Right, I'm not sure of that. I'm not sure that the kind of skill needed, the oral acuity, the physical dexterity, I'm not sure that that equates. I'm not saying it isn't, but I'm not so sure that it equates with IQ.
This has been shown in research. There's a correlation between IQ and the speed of response to a stimuli. The faster you respond to the change in the color of your screen, the higher IQ you tend to have. So that correlation shows the incredible deepness of this fact that all the things we value are correlated. And if we extract the thing that correlates all of the things together, we get the G factor. Well, something which tries to represent the G factor, which is an IQ score from an IQ test. Jordan Peterson tried to build a product to assess people's ability by his psychological tools. And it had a lot of potential, but it was a failure in the commercial front. Where I was going with IQ is that one of the biggest predictors of every positive thing in life is IQ. And IQ tests tend to be super reliable across time and across people. Do you think an IQ test should be the thing used to further meritocracy, or is it not a good measure?
Well, you're talking about what things, for college admissions or for what purpose?
For anything that is important in life and responsibility should be given to you.
I prefer operating on a person's past history of accomplishment, demonstrated skill, perseverance. I don't think these things are measured by IQ. I'm not upset about having IQ as one factor, but I don't think it should be the only factor because it's not the only measure of a human being.
If you mix IQ with the big five personality traits, ocean, openness, conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness, and neuroticism. If you get a percentile for each of those five, and those five can be subdivided into two subfields.
I'll tell you something else that's not necessarily correlated to intelligence, and that is being a good parent. I know some extremely intelligent people who are piss poor parents. I wouldn't want them as my parents. Egotistical. Anyway, don't get me started.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. Wisdom and IQ do not have to be correlated.
Yep.
You're not a better person for having higher IQ. That's just processing speed.
You may be a better scientist, though.
Yeah, but skepticism, scientists are curious by nature, but skeptic by training. And
yes.
The skeptic side, does it come with IQ? Or is a higher IQ allowing you to build a better narrative of why your bullshit idea is true? Maybe that's what it does in a lot of the cases, not in all of them, obviously. I tend to be really introspective and quite a skeptic about a lot of things. up to the point of sometimes questioning my own skepticism. I say, okay, why am I being so skeptical with this? Is there any reason behind why I'm so skeptical towards this certain topic or this certain thing? But with free speech, that doesn't happen, because I've noticed that all the arguments against free speech are seeking for a short-term, naive gratification. There's no wise reason why freedom of speech should be reduced.
Mm-hmm.
And in line with the ethos of my podcast, Escaping Mediocrity, the purpose of dialogue is to let ideas die instead of us. If you oppose freedom of speech, you're either going to kill the person in the other side or you will be killed. There's not much else apart from dialogue that we have as a way to avoid violence. Do you think we have anything else apart from dialogue as an alternative to violence?
Well, I suppose the benevolent dictator, the hereditary king, the Pope, the answer is no.
There was a quote from Jordan Peterson I'm trying to rehearse, which was, respect for the process that updates moral judgment is the highest of the moral stances. And I think he nailed it. If you not only recognize that there are some important ideas, but that there's a meta idea, which is the idea that allows other ideas to be changed. That idea is the most important, by far.
Go to the library and take out a book by Nat Hentoff.
I have it in my bookmarks now.
Good.